Good evening, warm welcome to Embodied Health Learning. A big warm welcome back to Kathy Dooley. Tonight is the 6th of January, 1 week before Kathy will be bringing her next exciting course to Embodied Health Learning. My name's Julian Marcus. I'm an integrative body worker and embodiment coach. And Kathy Dooley is many wonderful things. You would be called a clinical anatomist, wouldn't you, with your dissection history? And a doctor of exercise physiology?
No, chiropractic.
Chiropractic, And a chiropractor then?
I've been considering getting my PhD in exercise physiology, but yeah.
And tonight we'll be talking about the pelvic floor and the three-part course that starts next week at the same time as this, Wednesday. And Kathy has done such a wonderful job of a whole series of mini courses, three-part series, which are available at embodiedhealthlearning.com and go to courses. One was on lymphatics, which got Katie hooked, who now can't stay away. Anytime we're going to do something live, she comes around my house. And we also did gait, and we did the pelvis, as the joints of the pelvis, which will go really well with this one. And this one is good for everyone with a pelvic floor and those working with people with pelvic floors, which is most people. And if you have scope of practice, which Katie's course works directly with pelvic touch, then ears and eyes open for this treat. And thank you, Kathy. I'll shut up now, and I look forward to hearing about. Do you need to share your screen? Shall I give you screen sharing?
I would love privileges, if that's okay.
I'll give you some privileges. There you go. Thank you.
So I want to give a massive shout out to my friend, Kate Wolofsky. She works for the Kinsey Institute, and she's currently getting her PhD, and she was a research fellow for a while. And she and I were talking. She had come to my ID1 core concept course when it was in California, which we talk about the pelvic floor and its integration into core dynamics, which we will discuss in the future lectures here with Embodied Health for the next three Wednesdays. She inspired me. She was like, Kathy, did you ever think about doing like a pelvic floor course? And I was like, oh, no, people, there's already courses that exist for that. Like, I would just be redundant. And she's like, no, I don't think your perspective is redundant. I think that you should create something. And so it was November 2018 that I did my first. Maybe it was 19. I lied. It was November 2019 because it was right before the pandemic. She suggested that I do a pelvic floor course in California, and it sold out. And I was like, oh, people really do want to talk about this, and they want to hear as many perspectives as possible. I'm saying this to say that I'm not the only perspective. Right? I give a particular perspective that we do in Immaculate Dissection, and I teach a 4-hour course that's on this because of Kate. She inspired me to do that. So I want to give her a massive shout out. Hi, Kate. Hopefully you're watching. My big passion as far as the teaching of the pelvic floor anatomy is to dispel some myths about it. And there is a massive failure rate in pelvic floor therapy. There is also a pretty big failure rate in pelvic floor surgeries. And I think it's because we don't understand the pelvic floor very well, partially. And also I think some of the treatments are incomplete. I think that I'm really glad to hear that Julian and Katie are creating pelvic floor coursework for touch. I think that's an amazing thing to do. I also think that there is a disparity in knowledge that's no one's fault. And maybe it's because we don't study enough because the interest has been a little bit less. I mean, let's face it, like this whole area below here for sensory innervation is innervated by the pudendal nerve, and the word pudendal means embarrassed. So we've been like conditioned to like be embarrassed of this region, to not talk about it, to not want to bring it up to our general practitioners, or if we have brought it up, it's been cast away. The amount of trauma that happens in this region, and I'm not just talking about childbirth or prostatectomy or catheterization. I'm talking about trauma, like sexual trauma, that people don't want to bring up on an intake. Who wants to put on their intake when the first time they meet me, hey, I was sexually molested and it's affected my ability to be able to enhance my core stability. But it is important. Once I've built a trust with a patient, they may open up to me. I'm never going to ask, you know, but I do have a questionnaire that I'll share with you folks. And if they, and I tell them whatever you feel comfortable answering or asking, I'll answer. And I'd love to, you know, talk about whatever concerns you might have with this region. And the paucity of literature that's on the actual function of the pelvic floor is at first I was disconcerted by it. I was like, wait a minute, what does the pelvic floor do? And there are certain things that we know that it does and certain things that we're still unsure about. One of the things that I want to dispel as far as myths for you in the next three courses is that the pelvic floor is a breathing muscle. It's not a breathing muscle. You can't be a breathing muscle unless you attach to these ribs, okay? But it does contribute to the containment of breathing that helps us build intra-abdominal pressure and that helps us prevent prolapse. So just to share my screen with you for a second, some of the things that we'll be talking about for the next three Wednesdays, this is gorgeous art created by Danny Cork for macular dissection. This is the pelvic floor musculature. And if you're looking here, you can see that you have these hiatuses, right? The pelvic floor musculature is attached and hanging to different landmarks. The pubococcygeus, iliococcygeus are basically attaching to this thing called the tendinous arch of levator ani, and it's obturator internus fascia. This all sounds very technical, right? Basically, what I mean to say is that you have a hammock of muscles that are hanging from the fasciae, the slings, if you will, of another muscle, which means that there's a lot of interplay with hip mechanics and your ability to contain the bottom of your pelvis. And since this pelvic outlet, if you will, is allowing for passage to and from the outside world to the inside world of your true pelvis, these structures are not phasic. 80% of their fibers are tonic fibers. They're type 1A fibers, which means that there's always some tension there. And as a biped, this is a really important concept we'll be discussing in the next three Wednesdays, because I think one of the big failures of understanding the pelvic floor is thinking that it's phasic, thinking it's like a bicep that you can contract all the time. It really doesn't work that way. It's not about just pulling up on your pelvic floor. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying that's not always the right thing to do. And also, I'm not so sure that cueing that is completely efficacious to pelvic floor therapy. And I admit that I may have a confirmation bias because I treat so many people that fail traditional pelvic floor therapy. And again, I'm not saying pelvic floor therapy is bad. I'm just saying it has a kind of a high failure rate. And in my practice, it's like, well, I went to pelvic floor therapy and it didn't work. I'm like, that doesn't mean that pelvic floor therapy doesn't work. It may mean that we need to supplement this with an understanding of what else the pelvic floor has a contribution to. And for me, that means that I have to look at the building of gut pressure as an entity, which means that if the pelvic floor is helping me to manage the way that I build pressure in my abdomen, then I have to look at all the things that build pressure in my abdomen. I can't just do a release on these tissues and expect it to go well if tightness is there as a protective mechanism. And I liken the tightness of the pelvic floor that can occur to putting a parking brake on a car. Why do you do that? If you drive an automatic car and you park it on a hill, the brakes come on, you put it in park. Like, why do you put the emergency brake on an automatic car? You do it just in case something goes awry. And our bodies do something kind of similar. They do it through this amazing type of cerebellar mediated activity called spindle cells. And these muscles, they do have spindles, right? So if someone has tightness here, I think it's incomplete to just rub into it. I think that can be a beautiful part of the therapy. It can be an important part of the therapy, but I think it may be incomplete because if this is tightening because of other intra-abdominal musculature is not really doing its part, or maybe there's a discoordination between these tissues and the tissues of the rest of the intra-abdominal pressure building, then just rubbing it might actually make the patient more vulnerable. And that's what I've actually seen in my practice, where one of my patients just 2 weeks ago, she went to a pelvic floor therapist, and she was having, you know, she was told that she had, she was getting biofeedback, right? So they hook you up to some, you know, electricity, and they're able to read the contractility based upon cues, which again, I have a problem with, because these fibers are largely tonic and not phasic. And then she was asking the patient to contract and contract, and she had a decreased amount of activity in the anterior parts of the pelvic floor, which we'll call levator ani. And the patient, you know, was, you know, contracting, then she went home and was having all of these other symptoms. Like for her, it was thoracic diaphragm symptoms, erector spinae tension, and then her pelvic floor tone went down, but then tone went up in other places. And I'm like, I'm not in the business of robbing Peter to pay Paul. So that got my juices going. And I started to describe to her, I'm like, well, what we need to do is couple your pelvic floor therapy with an understanding of the entire container. And so as she started to hear me talk about other muscles that contribute to gut pressure, like the erectors, rectus abdominis, transverse abdominis, internal abdominal oblique, thoracic diaphragm, then she started to understand, like, oh, all of those things contribute to my pelvic floor tightness, not just my pelvic floor. And this is a really huge passion project for me, because as an anatomist and as a therapist, I think that if we do spot treatment, it can leave us a little vulnerable. We have to think of someone a little bit more holistically. And so for my patient, it was about her understanding that the pelvic floor tightness was a necessity for her to not have the diaphragm tightness, to not have the erector spinae tension, and that we needed to incorporate all of these structures together in therapy. So one of the biggest ways that I actually create therapeutic intervention for my patients is things that I'll share with you over the next three Wednesdays. And a big part of that is breathing, but not necessarily cueing the pelvic floor to do something, but to cue other things to support the pelvic floor better. And rather than pulling up or doing Kegels, which I think will have benefit for some people and also have limitations for some people, I think that we need to get the entirety of what we'll call the intrinsic core, the inner unit of core musculature that contributes to intra-abdominal pressure building and release. What we'll do is look at those tissues and how to cue those through breathing. And that's how the pelvic floor can contribute to the maintenance of gut pressure. This is not just for females, by the way. I think that females have a higher tendency towards pelvic floor problems because of parturition, because of the giving of birth, and because of hormonal changes and the fact that we have hormone receptors like estrogen receptors on these tissues. I treat actually equal amounts of males that have pelvic floor dysfunction. In fact, last week I saw four people with pelvic floor dysfunction. They were males and only two that were females. So it was interesting to see that disparity that is not so typically taught to us. And one of my patients, you know, had prostate cancer. Another one had urethral damage that was affecting his urogenital diaphragm and subsequent pelvic floor problems. So this is not just a female thing, is the point. This is a human thing. We are under more duress as a human. If you look at these tissues, if we're upright and we're containing everything from above, there has to be some tonicity here so that we don't prolapse things through these two holes that both males and females share. So this anterior one is called the urogenital hiatus, and the posterior one is called the anal hiatus. And in both sexes, we have it. And then in the female, there is a vaginal opening, and in the male, there isn't. So that'll be a really, really important distinction between, you know, the male and female anatomy, but it's not the only distinction. Like we have, females will tend to have a more gynecoid pelvis, a wider pelvis, which then puts even more tonicity into the tissue. And there's, you know, a little bit more fibrous tissue located between the two halves of the levator ani in the male, and then the female, of course, has the vaginal opening. So there's just a little bit more tendency to have the pelvic floor dysfunction because of hormones, because of more structures passing through. But please don't let that tendency to meet an absolute. Men have pelvic floor dysfunction, and they need help too. And if you're anything like me, once you start to open up that gate of I can help someone with a pelvic floor problem, they talk to people. Pelvic floor people talk to pelvic floor people. They're on forums together. They basically have support groups online for a lot of these problems. And what we need to do is normalize the discussion on it. And then more men and women will come out and talk about their pelvic floor problems. But what we'll talk about is the basic anatomy, and then we'll also talk about what you can do about it in these next three Wednesdays. I'm really, really excited to field some of your questions today about what you want the course to be like. And I'm not rigid. I want it to be what you guys want it to be. I can talk for 50 hours plus about pelvic floor, and we have three. But what I'll be focusing on, unless you tell me otherwise, is, you know, some questions I ask my patients. I'll share with you my questionnaire so you guys can learn, like, what is duly asked when it comes to pelvic floor dysfunction. When my patients fill it out, they're really fascinated by what they find. And they're like, I never really thought about this before, is the question I get a lot, or the answer I get a lot to my questions. And they're like, I never thought about, like, do I have to urinate as soon as my key goes into the door? How much of this is neurological? How much of this is physiological? And how does the neurophysiology of the pelvic floor play a role in things like continence, sex, containment, avoidance of prolapse, erectile dysfunction, basic pelvic floor health is multi-system. And the first Wednesday, the next Wednesday, we'll cover basic anatomy. And what I want to discern for you is, what's the pelvic floor, the pelvic diaphragm musculature, versus what's the urogenital diaphragm? Because people get those confused quite a bit, and we need to make a distinction. We also need to make a distinction of pudendal nerve and how it gets confused with nerve to levator ani and nerve to coccygeus. Pudendal nerve does not do direct motor innervation to the pelvic floor, and pelvic floor symptoms are sometimes mixed up with pudendal symptoms. So we'll discern those for you as well. And what we don't finish in the first Wednesday, as far as the basic anatomy, we'll cover in the second Wednesday. The second Wednesday, we're going to go over some of the clinical implications with the rest of the intrinsic abdominal stability system. We'll talk about things like the diaphragm, transversus abdominis, internal abdominal oblique, multifidus, erectors, and pelvic floor, and how you need all of those for any of those to go well. And so that's why you don't want to just do a palpation here. You don't want to just do touch therapy. You also want to integrate it into a systemic connection of the 25,000 breaths you take per day, the ambulation that you do, the 10,000 steps I hope you're doing per day, and how the pelvic floor plays a role in both femoral centration and the building of gut pressure. And then what time we have left on the third Wednesday, we'll talk about clinical management. Like, what does Dooley do for pelvic floor dysfunction? What kind of exercises does she get? What kind of visualizations does she give? How does she educate her patients on pelvic floor? And we'll go into things that might surprise you, like neurotransmitters, like things like serotonin, norepinephrine, estrogen, and how they play a role in pelvic floor health. If you're into it, we don't have to, but if you're into it, I'd love to talk to you about therapies like phalloplasty and vaginoplasty and how that changes pelvic floor relationships. So if you guys are into gender affirmation surgeries, I have nice data points on that. And of course, what always comes up is continence. If you're interested in learning a little bit more about what continence is, I think it may surprise you. People think the pelvic floor is responsible for continence, and it is part of it. But we'll talk about something called the vaginal-uterine axis and its relationship to why females get more incontinent than males. Not only because we have a wide hiatus, but because we start to lose some of our blood control over the mucosa of the vagina. So I'd love to open it up to any questions you guys have in the remaining 9 minutes about what you would like the course to be, what questions you might have about, you know, what to be is expected in the next 3 weeks. And we're going to have so much fun. We're going to have so much fun. But like any lecture, I want it to be what you guys want it to be. I want to make sure that you get your questions answered, that you bring in any kind of malunderstandings or just misunderstandings of what the pelvic floor is, and hopefully will ignite some discussion about what you're interested in and how you can better help your patients and yourself.
Thank you, Kathy. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know the final count, but there was way over 200 people expressed interest and registered for tonight. So some of you, if you want to ask Kathy questions or talk about themes or questions that you'd like covered in the course, then you're more than welcome in the chat here in or the Q&A in Zoom or on Facebook, posting below this live stream questions that you have, and we'll harvest those and share them with Kathy between now and next Wednesday. It sounds wonderful and that we need to do a longer one than 3 hours, which is true of all the other ones as well. But you cover a lot.
Cover a lot of stuff in 3 hours, as you
know.
You
do, yeah.
Looks like we have a question from the gallery. Do pelvic floor problems cause back problems? Whoo! I think that those two things are mutually enhancing to each other. They can also be mutually exclusive. Do all pelvic floor problems cause back problems? Not necessarily. Do back stability problems tend to encourage pelvic floor problems? Absolutely. So I notice a lot of my females and males after respective surgeries or parturition, giving birth, that they'll notice that they, when they have a pelvic floor problem, it coincides with a back problem. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the pelvic floor muscles and the back muscles are all part of this intrinsic abdominal stabilization of holding oneself upright. So they do tend to have a correlation, not necessarily a causation. I'd like the course to cover all the things Kathy just talked about. That you got it. You wish granted. That was easy. I love that. Yeah. And again, not only will we cover that, but and I'm assuming they're encouraging the gender affirmation. I always like to ask because some people are interested in it, some people aren't. Here in New York, you know, we get patients with more of the gender affirmation surgeries because we are one of the first places to have gender affirmation surgeries. And I want to open up that discussion. And as you know, your clientele may increase and you're, you know, have the honor and privilege of helping people, you know, recover from their surgeries or the complications that may arise in the pelvic floor due to those surgeries. It's very, very fascinating. My hope is that I can help the surgery take. If someone has this amazing surgery to become the one that they always wanted to be in themselves, right? The one that they deserve to be, then I want the failure rate to go down. If I can contribute to that in any kind of way by improving circulation and improving QE mechanics and have them appreciate their experience better, and that's for any of my patients. I want them to have a great experience in their life. I want their life to be a great experience. And if I can help them catalyze that, I'm darn well going to do it. So I love that you guys want to talk about it. So if we have time on that, that'll be you. Typically the third Wednesday is usually when I talk about that. But or if it comes up sooner, we'll handle it sooner. I can always skip ahead. There's no rules. If you get really, really interested, we can talk about it.
Some in the Q&A. Can you see the Q&A as well?
Q&A, I'm so sorry. Any recommended reading? Yeah, well, I'll share books that I really like. Anything written by Diane Lee and Leon Chateau. Their books on pelvic disorders are my two favorites. But I have a host of books I'll be sharing with you folks on reading. And I'll share with you guys my resources. I also have a litany of peer-reviewed literature. If you're interested in articles written about the pelvic floor, I have a ton to share with you. Can you talk about JADEG practice? It always comes up. pessaries and JADEG will definitely be discussed. I'm not the biggest advocate for either, but if you find something beneficial, I'll never negate it, but we will talk about it, but it won't be the highlight of my focus for sure. But I'll talk about it. If you really want me to, I'm happy to discuss it. I would not call myself an advocate. Will you also share about the function of vagus nerve related to pelvic organs? The vagus nerve is not related to pelvic organs. I'll talk about the absence of its relationship. Vagus does not innervate true pelvic organs. So the pelvic splenics do, S2, S3, S4. So I'll talk about the absence of vagus. I'm very happy to do that. That would be really fun for me. We'll definitely talk about the innervation of the pelvic floor and the lack thereof. A question concern when having a laparoscope done, will that affect the pelvic floor? Yes, we will talk about C-section and the effect on the pelvic floor based on gut pressure and cueing mechanisms through something called the conjoint tendon. So I would love to talk to you about that. Absolutely. The effect of constipation on the pelvic floor, there's no way I cannot talk about that. So we'll definitely talk about constipation in the relationship to the pelvic floor. Another person asks, will you be able to advise how to help clients with MS or Parkinson's? Yes. With MS and Parkinson's, the neurology, of course, is a little bit dyskinetic. It's a little bit delayed. And so you do need even more encouragement. Remind me of that question when you come back to the long course. And I'll talk about what I do with patients with MS and Parkinson's that's different. It's really not that different, to be honest. I always make the quote, no one gets a pass. But with people with MS and Parkinson's, they tend to need more stimulation. They tend to need more total repetitions, but you can't pre-exhaust them because they tend towards exhaustion a little easier because of their dyskinesia. So yeah, we can definitely talk about that. I'm interested in your thoughts of birth trauma on the pelvis and forceps C-section. That will definitely be covered. Don't miss out. So you definitely come for the three Wednesdays. It's impossible for me not to talk about those. So I'm so excited that you guys are interested in that. That's so great. Do you use acupuncture for scarring? I do. I am a trained acupuncturist, so I do use it for scarring and I use it for scar threading. I have only a couple of experiences in doing like Ren 1 needling there and episiotomy needling. It's extremely painful, and actually you don't have to do direct needling on the pelvic floor to have an effect on scarring. I usually do a little bit more of a distal points away from the direct threading on the Ren. I think there's ways to do it where you don't have to needle such a sensitive area. A headache and the pelvis protocol, Michael. Oh, we signed his name. I'm sorry. Headache in the pelvis protocol. I'm not sure what the pelvic protocol is. Do you just mean assessment, Michael? The relationship to headache and is very, very vast. A headache is a very, very general thing. So can you please talk about the relationship of the pelvic floor when someone has had a hip replacement? Sure. Again, impossible for me not to talk about it. These questions are all things that largely would be covered anyway. I love it. With the exception of MS and Parkinson's, I may have left that out. So I'm really glad that you guys asked. The relationship of hip surgery and pelvic floor will be what we call femoral centration. So I'll talk about the pelvic floor musculature and its relationship to femoral centration via the relationship with obturator internus muscle. So again, definitely we'll hit it. And please bring your questions, these amazing questions, just to make sure I cover everything, because I know I can talk a lot and I can cover a lot, but I just want to make sure that these questions are directly answered. So if I fall short, just remind me. I'm fairly certain that all of that will be covered in what I already have planned. But if for some reason I fall short, we'll leave Q&A. We'll leave like 10 minutes of Q&A at the end of each hour every Wednesday to make sure I get everything covered. Okay, so just hold me accountable.
Thanks. That's wonderful and really great that all those questions, bar one, are going to be included anyway. And people are saying they want you to do what you said you were going to do. So that's great. Okay. Two more have popped up. Can you speak about craniosacral 7 diaphragms balancing?
Yeah, it's impossible again for me not to talk about it. It's part of my lecture. Oh, I'm so glad that you guys know 7 diaphragms. That makes me happy.
And Michael's got back. Headache in the pelvis is a treatment in the USA book title of this name. Is it valid? So I don't know if you've
heard. Oh, I don't know that book. So I'll have to look that up, Michael. And I know that for headache, I treat the all 7 diaphragms that we'll discuss. So it makes sense that you can't not treat headache and treat the entirety. So I don't know their pelvis protocol. I only know my protocol to what I would do with headache, but I'll look it up before our lecture.
Great. And nice to hear you shouting out Leon Chater, who is a senior lecturer on my bodywork degree. And as the years roll by, I continue to be grateful that I got to meet and be
I just gave him. That so, you lovely. Were one of his students. I was one of his students that he never met, I guess, because I've just, you know, read everything he's written, and I really, really appreciate the work that he's done, the work that Diane Lee has done. These are phenomenal therapists and educators, and I'm honored to just share anything that they have and also question the things that they have too. I think it's really important to question me, to debate me and debate them, and because, you know, there's still a lot of mystery around that, because it's hard to surface EMG. It's really hard to, when I ask some of my anatomist colleagues that are like 50 years of experience, way more than my 2000 cadavers, like they've done, you know, tens of thousands of cadavers. And I ask them, you know, like they do a lot of research. I'm like, what does the pelvic floor do? And they're like, we're not really completely sure. And I'm like, oh man. And that would be disconcerting if it weren't exciting. Mm-hmm. Like, or let's discuss, let's talk about it. It is hard to EMG, that we know what it's innervated by. We understand, you know, some of it, and then some of it we don't understand. You know, as bipeds, we act differently than a quadruped. And you know, so it's fascinating to learn and study, but I have seen in myself, my pelvic floor condition vastly improved with what I'm going to discuss with you. I also am very proud and privileged to work with people with pelvic floor disorders. Ever since I started teaching a pelvic floor course, I get a lot of referrals for that problem, and people benefit from it so much. And I'm like, oh, this is working. This is great. And I love co-caring with pelvic floor therapists, because if their training is not exposed to doing some of this holistic training, then I can supplement what they're doing and make it work better. And that's what it's all about, is co-caring and having relationships with your colleagues and your patients, and not feeling like you're an island. Like, I'm the only one that can fix somebody. That's complete crap. You know, no, we need to be collegial and help each other to help the patient. And I think that's really what drives me, is helping you guys get enhanced at what you do and build a reality with your colleagues.
And that's what we celebrate here, is cross-platform, cross-discipline collaboration and learning and sharing in an embodied way. So we're all in the right place. Wonderful.
Educate me too. I'll share with you what I know, and then you share with me what you know. And Michael's already given me something to read before next Wednesday. And I love the idea of us sharing together and getting to know the pelvic floor better.
Yeah, me too. And thank you, everyone. Let's just check this one last thing.
Yeah, sure.
Q&A. Lucy, hi Kathy. I would really like to hear about the relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor. Thanks.
Impossible for me not to talk about. So I'm so excited that you want to hear about it. For me, the thoracic diaphragm is diaphragm number 5 out of 7, and then the pelvic floor is diaphragm number 6 out of 7. So I'll share with you some of our artwork from Immaculate Dissection that covers the 7 diaphragms and the 7 anatomic diaphragms, and you will have some fun talking about the building and release of intra-abdominal pressure.
Wonderful. So if your appetite's been wet, go over to the courses area on Embodied Health Learning to register for the course. There's a discount for members if you sign up for the year. We're still extending that offer because lockdowns have continued worldwide, sadly, that you can join for a year and get one course for free. I think that's still an offer. I'm going to be held to it if it's not. So this might be the course for you to join eHealth. We have plenty of other wonderful courses, as I've mentioned, from Kathy, which I highly recommend. And you'll get a further discount off those as a member. If you want to join and you're not a member, you can also take this course. It's £60. Again, a half price that we're offering and continuing to offer. So thank you, Kathy, for collaborating with us. And we look forward to seeing you next week at the same time for an hour that time. And it will be recorded. There'll be audio download, so you can replay and rewatch the slides and the audio offline on phone or whatever device. So see you all next week. I can't help but check one last thing. Can you help me with patients who have had multiple pelvic surgeries?
Yeah. Yes. It really doesn't matter. Like, I've had patients that have had, you know, prostatectomy where they didn't remove all of it and then go back in and remove more, or people with failed uterosacral ligament, you know, therapies, or sacrospinous ligament therapy that fail and then they redo it. And so, it really, with my assessment process, it's just like, where do they start? I have a standard operating system. This is where we start. And I never make the surgeries a bad idea. I never make any therapy bad or anything like that. It's just like, where are they at? And if you've had 7 surgeries, or if you had 1 surgery, I've seen 1 surgery with a person that's in way more discomfort than someone who has 4, you know? So it's really fascinating to see where the spectrum of where the person is And so you have to like be the objective for their subjective experience. So I think it won't matter how many surgeries they've had. I think it'll just matter how they present.
And I also want to shout out to the birth professionals, because a growing area of our work is with birth professionals. And John's designed this baby therapy course. So your course will be very interesting to the doulas, the midwives, and the postpartum care people on our sister platform, Our Birth Journey, which this is streaming to as well. And if you're a doula or a birth professional, you can sign up for the course there, I believe, also, and benefit from the differing content that's oriented especially to birth professionals and postpartum people. So just to mention that too. Thank you, Kathy, and I'll see you all next week. I hope you join us for the first of these three parts next week, everybody.
Can't wait. Bye, everyone.
Night. Bye-bye.